So if I sound like a little white Lonnie up here, everybody will get it, right? Finally, thank you. Thank you down here. This is my best material, and no one laughed. Lonnie and I can finally talk to one another. He finally understands me. See, I thought, man, I've got some sort of cold or something, so that's why I get the bottle of water. So we're going to start studying Jude today, and we are going to study it for 2 weeks. So we'll study it this week, we're going to introduce it, and all the background information to it, and then next week we're actually going to look into more depth in the book. I really enjoy studying the small books of the Bible. I think we overlook them for the most part. And don't really, or we read them rather quickly, or we pull out one verse or so, and we don't really understand a lot what's going on. And so I kind of enjoy studying them a lot. I know with Philemon, most of us grew up spiritually, Philemon verse 6, and that's about all we knew. You should be active in sharing your faith, which I'm suspicious that we've totally taken that out of context through the years, but that's just me. But I'm going to get in a fight with anybody about that. But when I was growing up, the verse was Jude 3. Contend earnestly for the faith once delivered to all the saints. And that probably is correctly used in the context of Jude. So Jude's a little bit different book than Philemon. Philemon was a good feel kind of book. It was, this thing was going on and we need to be forgiving and be like Jesus with people. And that is exactly what that was about. Jude is a different book. Jude is a book that is saying, hey, something big's happening here, and I want you guys to be aware of it because this is not a good thing. So it has a little bit different flavor to it. But it's something we need to know, if nothing else, because it's in the Bible, right? So we're going to learn it, but it really is, and it's very applicable to our time, and I'm going to kind of address that issue this morning. The author of the book, if you're going to look in Jude chapter 1, well, there's only one chapter, so I'll just say Jude verse. How's that? Yeah. Jude verse 1. Jude, a servant of Jesus Christ and a brother of James. There's different speculation about who Jude was. Some say that he was possibly the brother of Jesus. That's kind of the most common thinking, that he was because he was a brother of James. And we assume from that he is a brother of James, who was one of the leaders in the early church, in the church in Jerusalem, who was a brother of Jesus. We assume that's the James that he's talking about, and that probably is correct. We just don't know for sure. Some people have said that Jude is possibly one of the apostles named Judas, not Judas Iscariot, but the other one named Judas over in Acts chapter 1 mentions him, and I think also Mark calls him Judas. He had a couple different names that he went by. But some think it was possibly him. But in Mark chapter 6 and verse 3, if you just want to write that down and go look about it later, it talks about the people are talking about Jesus coming to their hometown, and they're saying, is this not the son of Joseph, and aren't his brothers James and Judas? And a couple of Simeon, I think, was one of them, or Simon. Aren't they with us? And so some people take it from that and say, well, that's who he's talking about here. And that's kind of the tradition of the early post-first century Christians, that it was him. But we really just don't know for sure. So if you think it's the brother of Jesus, that's fine. You know, just remember that's just a great opinion. Like everybody else's, right? We all get one. There you go. The date of the book. The date of the book is very... we're not really sure about this either. Some say it was written as early as 65 A.D. And that is because of its similarities to 2 Peter. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. And Peter was dead by about 65 A.D. He had been... killed in Rome at that point, allegedly being crucified upside down. So it's possibly then. Some say it could have been written as late as 80 AD. because of the issues that he deals with, which were very predominant at the time. We know according to church history. So it could have been kind of in the middle of all the books that were written in the Bible. It could have been the next to last book written in the Bible. It's a very possibility that it was written 80 AD and then nothing else was written in Revelation until the 90s when the book of Revelation was written. So we're not really sure about the time, but we have kind of a broad time range. And the way they, in case you haven't figured this out now, the way they date books of the Bible, a lot has to do by the issues that are discussed in those books. And the big issue near the end of the first century was people who believed in a divide between the spirit and the body. It was called pre-Gnosticism. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But because Jude seems to talk about that so much, people say, well, this looks like kind of one of those books, so it may have been written closer to 80 AD than 65 AD. The purpose of the book, if you want to look in verse 3, is, "Dear friends, although I was very eager to write to you about the salvation we share, I felt I had to write and urge you to contend for the faith that was once for all entrusted to the saints." It seems that Jude was originally planned to write, or he was thinking about writing by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, a book about just a very encouraging book. And then this issue kind of became more prominent. And so he said, you know, I think I really need to address this. And we're not really sure who the recipients were, so that's kind of hard to figure out a little bit. Because it just says in verse 2, to those who have been called. You know, different than like the epistle to the Ephesians or the Laodiceans or to the seven churches of Asia, right? Is that right in Revelation? I said it right? Yeah, the seven churches in Asia. We kind of know who the recipients were. Here it just says to those who were called. So this is to all Christians living in the first century who would actually receive the book. So it was a book originally just talking about this common salvation, but then he says, I feel I have to talk to you about contending for the faith. Contending there carries with the concept of argument and debate. Not argument like we think argument. Not arguing, but it's more of a public debate type thing. And he says, I feel like you need to address these issues in a public way and even in a confrontational way, much of the way the Greeks did. The Greeks were very big on public debates, to where this guy would take this side of an issue, this guy would take this side of an issue, and they discussed that in a public debate. Very unlike what we call the presidential or the vice presidential debates. Those aren't real debates. Those are policy statements and then snippeting each other, which is totally not what a debate means in the Greek or an argument means. It's the concept of side by side going back and forth. And so Jude says, you know, I want you to contend or get out here and talk about these issues in a public way because they're that big. And we're going to talk about false teachers in just a second. one book I was reading, they said that Jude was one of the first whistleblowers. That's the way we understand it, right? A guy goes and works for a company and he says, oh, there's something going on shady here and I got to go public with this. And just think about Jude like that. He was just coming on and he said, hey, there's something going on here and I've got to go public and talk about it. So he was like one of the first whistleblowers ever, in terms of bringing up an issue that was kind of simmering among the churches, but nobody was really addressing it in a public way. And Jude said, hey, we got to talk about this because it's a big deal. And it was a false teaching or false teachers of lifestyle, some teachers that he wanted to address. So the author's Jude, the date 65 to 80 AD, the purpose was to talk about some false issues that were going on in the church and to address those in a public way. Okay, hold on a second. This is water, so. Okay, let's talk about, I'll give you kind of a good background. Let's talk about false teaching in the first century. False teaching. We live in a society even in our age, in the year 2009, where the concept of a religious false teaching is almost like, it's just not something we even talk about. We talk about religion in America, somebody brings up false teaching, the person who says those words is looked down upon as some sort of a nut. Right? If you think about it. If you say, well, I think so-and-so is a false teacher, you looked up on as like some backwoods guy who's been sitting over there, you know, looking at ignorant things, and you just bring it up because you got an axe to grind with somebody. Now, when I was growing up in the 50s, the late 50s and the early 60s, when we first started going to church, that was a very common discussed topic in America. Particularly if you were a member of the traditional Church of Christ. The traditional Church of Christ was very strong, and sometimes it wasn't done in the correct way, but it was very strong, for the most part, in talking about what were perceived as what were false teachings that were being promulgated by the denominational world. And I kind of grew up that way. I grew up hearing that. The first minister I ever had, the traditional Church of Christ, he talked about that a lot. And he was a very courageous man. He was a very bold man. Sometimes, you know, he didn't say it the right way. But for the most part, he didn't let things slide about stuff like that. Well, now, if he were to come in some of churches today, he used to preach on the radio all the time. I was on the radio one time preaching, by the way, in case y'all won't know that. Yeah, I was a radio star. I was in Oneida, Tennessee. I was kind of the Neil Bortz of Oneida, Tennessee for a while. So you know, he would get on the radio and he'd preach these things. Well, if he came and did that today, his program would probably last about two times. Because it'd be canceled. Because, you know, he just wanted to talk about these things. And but in the first century, that was very normal. They talked about false teaching. They did not believe that the only verse in the Bible that means anything is Matthew chapter 7 and verse 1. Judge not that ye be not judged. Which is totally taken out of context, but that's a whole different issue. But in the first century, they knew that wasn't what Jesus meant. Because Jesus also said, judge righteous judgment. And by their fruits you shall know them. Right? I mean, he's the one that said that, you know. And he said, beware of false teachers. So I think what we need to do, if I could just say this, and I will. I think we need to go back. Some of us need to go back and look at that. And we need to take on more of that thing, more of that quality. I don't think we're going to worry. I'm not worried about any of us saying it wrong. Most of us saying it wrong. But we need to take on that quality of saying, you know, that is not in the Bible. The Bible does not teach once saved, always saved. The Bible does not teach you baptize little babies. The Bible does not teach homosexuality is fine. It does. Those are false teachings. And I think we need to say that in a respectful way, but we need to say that and not be afraid to say that. For one thing, it'll create some great dialogue with people. As opposed to just when people say things like that, just going, well, yeah, yeah, I can see where you're coming from. Which I hope you're saying that less and less in your vocabulary. I can see where you're coming from. You know, we're trying to soften that. And I don't mean, we don't need to soften that all the time. We say, you know what? Where does the Bible say that at exactly? Just ask people that. So in the first century, though, that's what they did. And there were basically two types of false teaching in the first century. The one that happened pretty much after Jesus ascended back into heaven were the Judaizers. The Judaizers. And the Judaizers, or Hebrew Christians, or Jewish Christians, whatever you want to call them, they were the ones who had become, who decided to follow Jesus. But they wanted to bring all their Judaism with them. If you look in Acts chapter 15, we're going to look at two verses in the book of Acts. Acts chapter 15, starting in verse 1. And this is the first time, it's not the first time it's been brought up, but the first time it becomes a church-wide issue. Some men came down from Judea to Antioch, which is where, you know, they were baptizing all the Gentiles, and were teaching the brothers, unless you are circumcised, according to the custom taught by Moses, you cannot be saved. Now notice what happened. Paul and Barnabas said, judge not that ye be not judged. They said, well, I understand where you're coming from. This brought Paul and Barnabas into sharp dispute and debate with them. They just practiced Jude 3 before it was written. Right? They just went into it. They said, no, no, no. That's not true. And so this was one of those situations where they're trying to make circumcision part of being a Christian. And that it wasn't part of the deal. Look in Acts chapter 22. I'm sorry, Acts 21. And it comes up again, but it's handled a little bit different way. Acts 21 is one of the most, it's one of the most mysterious books in all the chapters in all the Bible to me. So if you ask me what happened, I'm going to say, I have no earthly idea. Paul comes to Jerusalem and reports what's been done among the Gentiles. In verse 20, it says, when they heard this, they praised God. Then they said to Paul, you see, brother, how many thousands of Jews have believed, and all of them are zealous for the law. They have been informed that you teach all the Jews who live among the Gentiles to turn away from Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children, live according to our customs. What shall we do? They will certainly hear that you have come, so do what we tell you. There are four men with us who have made a vow. Take these men, join them in their purification rites, pay their expenses so that they can have their heads shaved. Then everybody will know there's no truth in these reports about you, but that you yourself are living in obedience to the law. That's the law of Moses, guys. That's not the law of Jesus. But I'm just saying. As for the Gentile believers, we have written to them our decision that they should abstain from food sacrificed to idols, from blood, from the meat of strangled animals, and from sexual immorality, which is what they had said back in Acts chapter 15. So, this is kind of an unusual verse. And it seemed like for a period of time, God allowed people who were Jews to gradually move out of all that. And the apostles said, okay, we're going to help them move out of that, but we're going to kind of give up some of our rights. We're not going to treat them as matters of faith to anybody else. We'll treat it as a matter of opinion. I'll pay the purification rites. I'll get my head shaved. I'll go down to the temple and all that. But Timothy and Titus and all these Greeks, they don't have to do it, but I'll do it if it'll help these Jews. So all that was going on. So what this did, though, is that the Judaizers, though, they wouldn't let some of these things go. Is everybody with me so far? Okay, so by the time you go to Colossians chapter 2, now here's the church at Colossae. He's writing to them. And in verse 16, and there's a Colossian heresy. We don't know exactly what it was, but it was some sort of strange mixture of Judaism and a worship of angels and discipleship. It's some sort of strange concoction somebody brewed up. But he says in verse 16, he says, therefore do not anyone judge you by what you eat or drink, or with regard to a religious festival, a new moon celebration, or a Sabbath day. These are a shadow of things that were to come. The reality, however, is found in Christ. And then he talks about the angel worship and so forth, and then about something else. But you can see right here, by the time Colossians was written, which is about 45, 49 A.D., somewhere in that time frame, that this was a big issue in the church about worshiping on the Sabbath. Is that part of it? Is circumcision part of it? And you have these Judaizing teachers who are saying, yeah, it is. You gotta be circumcised. You got to go on the Sabbath. You got to go Sunday, you know. You got to get your head shaved to be a Christian. Now you say, well, how big was it? There's a book in the New Testament called Hebrews. That's how big it was. Hebrews is addressing that whole issue about dealing. At that point, basically the Hebrew writer is saying, look, Judaism's done with. We're not going to address this anymore. You don't have to be a Jew. You don't have to take on Jewish customs to be a Christian. So it's over and done with. Let it go. Just say no. Okay? So that's why that was written. So you can see, this was a false teaching that the early Christians had to deal with. The second false group of false teachers were what I call the Hellenists. Now, these aren't people from Helen, Georgia. Hellenists. H-E-L-L-E-N-I-S-T-S. The Hellenists. Or people who believed in Hellenism. And that has nothing to do with hell. Alexander the Great lived about 300 years before Jesus was born. Now, Alexander the Great went out to conquer the world. Okay, one of the things that he decided to do that pretty much no one had ever done before is that every place that he conquered, he made it Greek. He took on the Greek language. They took on Greek architecture. That's why you'll see places in Egypt that have Greek architecture. You see places in Turkey, places like that that he conquered, that have Greek architecture in it. Because he said, wherever I go, I'm just not going to assimilate them into the Greek culture. I'm going to make them Greek. They're going to speak the Greek language. They're going to have Greek architecture. They don't want to be Greek, then they can be dead. That's just the way he thought. Okay? And which is, you think, wow, boy, that was a bummer. Well, not really. Because think about this, by the time Jesus was born, everybody in the then known world spoke what language? And do you remember what language the Bible was written in? Koine Greek. So God used Alexander the Great to set up the expansion of Christianity 300 years before. Because that was a common language then at that point, was Koine Greek and Aramaic. So, he has this philosophy of Hellenism, so everybody's going to be Greek. We'll say, well, how did that affect the early church? Look in Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17. There's a second philosophy that was running around, a second false teaching, that started out of Hellenism. And it was what we call Gnosticism. Or at the time when Jude was written, we call it pre-Gnosticism. And it was this belief that had come out of all these years of Greek philosophy. In Acts chapter 17, starting in verse 17. So Paul reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks. You see that? The Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him, and we can stop right there. The Epicureans and the Stoics were of two totally different ways of looking at life. The Epicureans were the Hugh Hefners of their day. Everybody know who Hugh Hefner is? The guy who started Playboy magazine. They were the eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. They were totally into worldliness, totally into passion, totally fulfilling every desire you might have, no matter what it is. Your body desires to be satisfied with food, with drink, with sex, whatever it is, go after it. Those are the Epicureans. Okay? They would think Tiger Woods was an amateur. They read back then what Tiger Woods did, you know, is coming out now. It wouldn't even make the headlines in Athens. Or Corinth. Corinth, it wouldn't even been in the paper. That's what they all did anyway. They were the Epicureans. The others were the Stoics. The Stoics came about kind of as a response to the Epicureans. They said, oh, that's not right. So what we got to do is we just got to think all the time. And so they were the Spocks. Now, you didn't get the Hugh Hefner one, but you got the Spocks. Okay, so you got the Hugh Hefners and the Spocks. talking to Paul. I said, well, what are you driving at? Well, what happened was they started kind of meshing together through the years, getting closer to each other. And those people, that was the main impact in the Gentile world. And so they became Christians. And so you have a group of Christians now who are totally impacted by this. And they came up with this concept around when, if you don't go to Jude, when Jude was being written, that they know you can't be a Hugh Hefner. That's wrong. And it sounds like Spock sounds more like the way it ought to be. But you still got these desires, so what do you do about them? Well, you kind of let your body just roam free as long as you stay pure in your mind. And that was basically the beginning of Gnosticism. That as long as you're trying to keep your mind pure and trying to think, you know, spiritual things, Gnostic type things, knowledgeable type things, then your body, you can do whatever you want to do with it. Because it's not in charge anyway. You can't control your body anyway. And besides that, aren't we all saved by the grace of God? Well, we are. Don't say it. That wasn't a good time to say amen. Sorry. I should have continued. That was a wrong timing is everything, brother, whoever said it. That's funny. Look at the end of that second half of verse 4. Now, I know we went a long way to get to this, but I think it's good to know all that, to know what these guys are thinking, and to know why this was such a big deal, is because it permeated their society. There are things, you know, in our society, just permeate our society, that if we go tell somebody it's wrong, they think we're a nut. You know, they think we're crazy. Because it's permeated society for so long. You know, it's kind of like I said at the beginning. You go out and you start talking about homosexuality being a sin, and immediately you're homophobic. Immediately. And that you hate people who are homosexuals. It's like, and no matter how you try to talk around it, it's still, because it's so permeated in us, we just don't think about it, you know? I was reading this article yesterday about this guy, Garrett Blunt, who was a football player that got thrown off the, remember the first of the year, all the men remember, this guy who punched the other guy at Boise State, and, you know, they tossed him out for the season, and his whole life's kind of turned around, and at the end of it, though, they talk about him seeing his child after the football game, his newborn baby boy, but the child's born. His fiance have never got married, and so the child's, you know, born out of wedlock. And it's like, I'm just reading that and thinking how sweet that is. And finally, after a few seconds, I thought, well, wait a minute, hold on, Senior Gary, you missed this, because we're so permeated with it. Okay, so they're so permeated with this. At the end of verse 4, it says, they are godless men who change the grace of our God into a license for immorality and deny Jesus Christ, our only sovereign and Lord. That's why he wrote that in there, because of this Hellenistic view of thinking. That they become Christians and they change the grace of God into a license for sin. They said, well, I can do all these things. God really doesn't care because I'm saved by grace anyway. And then he goes from there and starts talking about what they're really like. And we'll talk about that more next week. Say, well, boy, how in the world would they accept that? Well, if you think about it, in our religious world, we've accepted the same thing in the religious world of America. We just call it once saved, always saved. Once saved, always saved is a license for immorality. If you think about it. Because what people will tell you, and you see this all the time, you'll see someone who believes in that, practices it, but they will never say anybody's done anything wrong. And if they do something wrong, they especially pull that card out and want to play it. Well, you're unfaithful to your wife. Well, you know what? I'm saved by the blood of Jesus. Well, you lied. I know, but I'm saved by the blood of Jesus. Well, you cheated on your income tax. I know, Phil. But I'm saved by the blood of Jesus. And see, that's what that is. It's a license for immorality. And so, it's just not a pernicious doctrine that's not in the Bible or that, you know, maybe we heard when he was growing up as a little kid. It is a license for immorality. That's why, and we're not going to beat on Tiger Woods this week, but that's why when this first came out, the revelations, this past week or so of what Tiger Woods had done, one of the first people I read said, "Now, I don't want to judge him." I thought, yeah, I bet that's exactly what his wife told him to. I bet she said, "Honey, I don't want to judge you on these things." Do you think she said that? No. I imagine that golf club was not for rescuing him from the car. That's just my personal opinion. I think that was a chase down tool. She caught him when he wrecked. So, but that's what people say, and that's why they use it as a license for immorality. You say, well, it doesn't seem to be too damaging. But if you look through the rest of the book of Jude, which you'll look about, you'll see how damaging it is. Because people go from that to doing anything. And pretty much Jesus is totally out of the picture. Okay. So we'll come back and we'll look at that next 2 weeks. Okay. A couple other special insights about Jude and then we'll stop. These are special insights about Jude. First of all, his relationship to 2 Peter. Most people who read 2 Peter and Jude realize that, they probably talk to one another. Because 2 Peter chapter 2 and the book of Jude almost sound identical. Use a lot of the same illustrations, use a lot of the same terminology. They did get it from the same source, God. That was not hard to figure out. But they did borrow a lot of the same terminology. That's why they think maybe they were written around the same time. The second special thing about Jude are his references to the apocryphal books. There's two books that he quotes. The first book is in verse 9, where he quotes his story. He says, "But even the archangel Michael, when he was disputing with the devil about the body of Moses, did not dare to bring a slander accusation against him, but said, 'The Lord rebuke you.'" That is from the Testament of Moses, which is an apocryphal book. The Testament of Moses. It was written about, they think, anywhere from 200 to 300 years before Jesus was born. That is an apocryphal book. If you look over in verse 14, Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men. "See, the Lord is coming with thousands upon thousands of his holy ones," and so forth through verse 15. That is from the book of Enoch, which was an apocryphal book. You say, well, why in the world is he quoting from apocryphal books? Well, they were just popular religious literature of his time. That's all they were. They weren't necessarily looked upon as inspired, but they were popular religious literature of the time. You say, well, is it okay for him to do that? Well, I think if it's okay for Paul to quote from a Greek comedian, 1 Corinthians 15:33, did you know that was a popular quote from a Greek comedian? "Bad company corrupts good morals." That was like Paul saying, now, you know, Jay Leno said on his show the other night, that's what he was doing. He's quoting from a popular Greek comedian of his time. Titus 1 and verse 12, "Cretans are always liars." Cretans are always liars. That was a popular saying back then, but it was a popular quote. But from a Cretan philosopher, a philosopher from Crete. And so Paul quoted from non-inspired sources. And I imagine it's okay for Jude to do it as well, don't you think? It's all right. He didn't say they were inspired. He just said, these are some things that happened, or these illustrations of what I'm talking about. And the final thing about Jude that is really, really amazing, that nobody else does it the way he does, is he gives a stamp of authenticity to biblical events like nobody else. He gives a stamp of authenticity to biblical events. Verse 5, he mentions the Exodus as an event that actually occurred. Verse 6, he mentions angels being demoted from heaven as an event that actually occurred. Verse 7, he mentions the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah as an event that actually occurred. Verse 11, he says Cain was a murderer. That wasn't a falsified story. Verse 11, he mentions Balaam and his greed. Remember the story of Balaam and the donkey? That's what he's talking about there. He said, this was a story that really happened. Korah's rebellion, verse 11, this really happened. And so he puts a stamp of authenticity upon those things, saying, you know what, these events really occurred, and these people that are here today are just like the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. They're just like the Cain. They're just like Balaam, who was greedy. They're just like Korah, who led a rebellion. They're exactly like them. And so you got to watch out for them. He pulls out some of the most infamous characters in all the Bible and say, these same people are here today. And guess what, brothers and sisters? Those same people are still alive today. Their spirit is still alive. We have people today who have a spirit of Korah in them. But they want to rebel against the authority. They want to rebel against the church leaders. And daggone it, they're going to do it. That is the spirit of Korah. Everybody remember what happened to Korah? You don't want that to happen to you. You don't be swallowed up by the earth. People are greedy like Balaam, who are Christians. We shouldn't be that way. People in their heart kill people. And then sit beside them in church the next Sunday. That's what Cain did. And hopefully you figured out the Sodom and Gomorrah reference. You know, it still says, guess what? Homosexuality is still a sin. And these people today practice it. So, those are the things that are special, peculiar about insights about Jude. What we're going to do when we come back, 2 weeks. Now, next week's Christmas show, right? It'll be a little bit more uplifting than today. we come back and talk about Jude in a couple of weeks. We're going to talk about just what he said, some highlights, some different things he talks about. I really want to encourage you to read it. Don't read this next week. Read it a week after that so you'll be ready. And we'll talk about Jude and what all said in that in 2 weeks. So thanks for your attention this morning. Go get your children. There you go. Thank you. Thanks.